Bible Worm, Bible Worm, reading the Bible with Bible Worm.
Welcome to Bible Worm, getting to the core of the biblical text. I'm Dr. Amy Robertson, Director of Lifelong Learning at Congregation Or Hadash in Sandy Springs, Georgia.
And I'm Dr. Robert Williamson, Professor of Religious Studies at Hendricks College and the founding pastor of Mercy Community Church in Little Rock. We're here every week to discuss the biblical text, both as biblical scholars and as people of faith, one Jewish and one Christian.
This week, we read Isaiah chapter 6. We step into the incredible sense of awe Isaiah describes as he stands among the skirts of God's robe and witnesses the angelic liturgy. We understand why, standing there, he would feel lost and out of place. And we see a God whose angels both recognize Isaiah's human inadequacies and help him address them rather than sending him away. And we wrestle a little bit with the verses that follow, the heavy weight of the call Isaiah has accepted. Thank you for joining us. Hello, Bobby.
Hey, Amy. How are you this week?
I am doing pretty well. We have adopted out our first foster dog, well, our first long-term foster dog, and replaced it immediately on the very same day with two other foster dogs.
That's not the way that's supposed to go, I don't think.
There are just a lot of dogs that need foster homes, I guess. But so yeah. We're getting used to some new dogs, and they're so cute and so annoying.
How old are they?
It's a mama and a puppy. And the mom is about 5, and the puppy is maybe 8 weeks, but still nursing. So they'll be with us. Like, we can't even get them fixed until, you know, they're finished with their nursing relationship. So
yeah,
it'll be a minute.
Yes. I had a 7-week-old puppy once, and I will hopefully not have a 7-week-old puppy again.
They're so cute and so annoying.
Oh, they really are cute. Yeah, I would love to come to your house and visit with your 8-week-old puppy.
We have made many new friends because we have a puppy.
Yeah.
So the narrative lectionary for us is Isaiah chapter 6, verses 1 through 8.
Yeah.
Which is just beautiful. It's such a beautiful text. We are, you know, as we often
so
are.
So we're going to ruin it.
Hoping to get to the end of the chapter.
Yeah.
Which is just a handful of additional verses, but the tone shifts in what feels like an important way in the second part of this chapter. And so we do want to include it. And also, we will do our very best to ensure that it does not act to the detriment of the enormous beauty in those first 8 verses.
Yeah.
Can you offer us some background and orientation as we head into this chapter?
Isaiah himself, Isaiah ben Amoz, son of Amoz, was a prophet in the 8th century in the southern kingdom of Judah. He was a prophet during the reign of the southern kings Ahaz and Hezekiah in kind of a tumultuous period in Israelite history. So I think Isaiah is interesting because, yeah, I mean, this text is beautiful. This text is spiritually a very rich text. And also, he is engaged in some really complicated political realities and trying to think about the relationship of his religious faith to the political future of the nation that he's a part of. So there is this kind of practical dimension to Isaiah as well.
So with that, should we dive in?
Let's do it.
Okay, so we are in chapter 6, and we are going to start with verses 1 through 3. And I am reading from the NJPS. In the year that King Uzziah died, I beheld my Lord seated on a high and lofty throne, and the skirts of his robe filled the temple. Seraphs stood in attendance on him. Each of them had 6 wings. With 2 he covered his face, with 2 he covered his legs, and with 2 he would fly. And one would call to the other, "Holy, holy, holy, the Lord of hosts. His presence fills all the earth." Okay, this I think is an astoundingly beautiful image that I want to dive into in just one little second. But can you place us historically? King Uzziah was not a king that you mentioned when you were giving us background.
Yeah, that is true. And, you know, Ahaz is his grandson and Hezekiah is his great grandson. And those are the kings that really are the kings in the bulk of Isaiah's prophecy. But you're exactly right. Like, this opens with King Uzziah. He was king of Judah for a really long time, for 40 years. His dates are somewhat disputed, but basically the entire first half of the 8th century in Judah, King Uzziah was the king. And so this was a really stable time. We had a king on the throne who had longevity and brought stability to the kingdom. And so I think that that's important when this text begins in the year that King Uzziah died. Mm-hmm. Historically, we're probably somewhere around 742, 736. Those dates are disputed a little bit, but it's just over the halfway mark of the 8th century. At the same time when Uzziah dies, Assyria in the east is kind of going through this transformative period. And so there's political instability in the region, and King Uzziah's death brings political instability in Judah as well. Mm-hmm. But I think that notion that the year that King Uzziah died, I mean, that's an interesting way to introduce a text, right? You don't see that often. And I think it may not be accidental that Isaiah gets this kind of profound commissioning in a year where there's that kind of political transition.
Yeah, I mean, those shifting moments are precisely when it feels like everything is sort of cracking open one way or the other, because we don't know what lies ahead. And as we're coming into a period of more instability, we can sort of look back upon it and say that, yeah, it's an interesting moment to have a call. Although, you know, one can imagine, if we're thinking about it, sort of Isaiah almost as a character in a story, one can imagine that in the year that the king died, you don't know yet what's ahead, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, there's some instability that comes whenever you're, you know, there's a transition in leadership, but they might not know the extent to which things are going to become a little crazy.
I really appreciate the way you've said that. Yeah. So it's not that it's clear that it's going to become unstable. It's just that there is a moment of uncertainty in a tumultuous time. And so everything feels very fraught.
Yeah.
So you don't know quite what's coming, but there's some anxiousness about what might be next.
Okay. Can we move on to this image?
Yes.
Of the skirts of the Lord. Oh, gosh. Bobby, I mean, where do you even start? Like, what does this evoke for you? What are you sort of picturing? What kind of image comes to your mind when you read even just this first verse?
I mean, the first thing that really strikes me is that last image, that, like, the hem of the robe, like, you are barely, like, I'm assuming this is like a floor-length robe, right? And so in the temple, God is so immense that the only thing you actually can see is, like, the very tip of the robe, like, just at, like, God's, you know, like, the back of God's heel maybe fills the temple. Just the enormity of that image.
And so God is seated not in the temple, but, you know, presume if you're trying to think, like, to scale, like, God's hips, if God is scaled like a human, I mean, who knows? But, like, where God's, like, actually seated is way up, right, in the heavens, presumably. So I don't know. It is a funny thing to think, like, what could Isaiah as a human really, like, see with his own eyeballs?
Yeah.
So my translation has, instead of the hem of God's robe, the skirts of God's robe, which they're referring to the same thing, right? It's just the bottom of the robe that sort of falls in, enfolds a little bit. Like, you can sort of picture the bottom of a robe or the bottom of a skirt that has a little extra material. And I'm glad that my translation chose that particular word, because it sort of led me down this whole path of associations of sort of, have you heard the phrase, like, being in your mother's skirts, like, when you're little, when you're so little and your mother seems so big?
Yeah.
And you want to be as close to her as you can, but there's this sort of billowing thing that's sort of in the way, but sort of comforting, and you know that she's in there. Because her skirts are there, you know that she's in there. But it feels striking to me that it's not that you see the foot of the Lord. Yeah. Or, you know, the heel of the Lord or something like that. It's that you see these billowing skirts that, you know, that the Lord is there. But there's proximity, and you can sort of, like, bury yourself in them in some ways. But but there's also a little bit of distance or mystery, or you could get lost in there, or I don't know.
I love that imagery. Yeah, so it's intimate. But yet at the same time, there is some distance or some, like, mystery about it. I love that image.
Okay, so we've spent a long time on verse 1. Let's move on
to
these seraphs. And they're six wings.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any thoughts about why they're covering their face and their legs. I just think it's that image is so strange to me.
So yeah, so the seraphim. So the word seraph is related to the word for burning in Hebrew. And so these are some kind of fiery, divine fiery creatures. We don't really know what the seraphim looked like. But yeah, I mean, you're right. They have six wings covering their faces, covering their feet, and then they're flying with the other two. And, you know, the covering of the faces, I think, is an indication that even the angels, even the divine beings in the presence of God, they are being respectful, I think.
Yeah.
By covering their faces so as not to gaze on God and, like, be offensive in that kind of a way. Or at least that's the way I've kind of tended to read that. The covering of the legs or the covering of the feet, probably the most reasonable way to read that in my mind is that feet there is being used, as it often is in the Hebrew Bible, as a euphemism for genitals. Mm. And so they're covering themselves in that sense. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I think it's about modesty, but I don't quite know how you get there. Do you have thoughts about that?
I mean, I love what you're saying. I honestly didn't have a very deep image in my mind reading this. I was just like, that's weird. Like, it seems awkward to have six wings and cover your face and cover your legs or your feet and then fly with the other two. It seems awkward, but your
it
reading
is super awkward. Yeah,
your like, reading is much more resonant. Yeah, that it's telling us something about the relationship between the seraphim and God.
Yeah,
I think is the way to read that. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah,
and then it tells us how these seraphim are calling back and forth to each other.
Yeah.
These words, holy, 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 which I know at least in the Jewish tradition is really taken to be a way for us as humans to access how the angels pray, how the seraphim worship.
Oh, that's interesting.
God.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the Jewish tradition, we recite this specifically within the Amidah, which is really a central prayer of Jewish communal life. It's recited very frequently. And try to aspire to pray like the angels during this part. And as we say, holy, 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 with each time we raise to our tiptoes, like we're trying to elevate ourselves to be more like the angels in our worship.
I love that. Yeah. I think oftentimes Christians, at least the Christians that I am among, sort of lose the sense of the holy a little bit. Like we focus on other important aspects of God, like compassion and mercy and justice and love and things like that. And sometimes the idea that just like, let's pause for a minute and think about the fact that God is holy, I think that can sometimes escape us. Mm-hmm. So I really love that sort of the daily prayer, this praying in the language of angels and the using your body as you do that. I think that's a really, really rich tradition.
We should also use our wings to cover our faces and our...
yeah.
Run out of
wings. I love the second line of that. The whole earth is full of his glory.
Yeah.
And so we've just talked about how that, you know, God's so grand that the temple can only contain the hem of the robe.
Yeah.
And here you get that image that you were talking about. Like if you put this up to scale, like God is sitting on the earth or something.
Yes, you really get a sense of the grandeur of God's presence here. Mm-hmm. And I think for me, if we had not come from this image of the hem of God's robe itself filling this magnificent structure on earth, the concreteness of that image really helps me get to that bigger image of God's presence truly filling the earth.
Yeah.
Okay, should we go on? Are we ready to go
Let's
on?
Yeah.
Okay. Verses 4 and 5. The doorposts would shake at the sound of the one who called, and the house kept filling with smoke. I cried, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my own eyes have beheld the King, Lord of hosts."
Yes.
You know, when I first read these verses, I was like, wait, the one who called, what are we talking about? Who is the one who called? But you have to look back to verse 3 for that, right?
Right.
There's this idea that angels are calling back and forth to each other.
Yeah.
These words. And their calling apparently makes the doorposts or what, I mean, that we don't know exactly what that word is, but
yeah,
it's making the structure itself shake again.
Yes.
Like this most tremendous and grand structure that humans could build for God's sake. itself is shaking with the holiness of this encounter, with the power of this prayer experience, with this way of acknowledging God's presence. It's, you know, as you said, it really underscores this holiness aspect of God.
Yeah, I think that's right. I love the way that you have worded it there. It's kind of, I mean, it's a terrifying thing, right? When these creatures are calling back and forth to each other, like it is, it's like an earthquake is happening. Like, mm-hmm. and every time they say, holy, 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 like the whole thing shakes.
Yeah.
The NRSV has the house filled with smoke, but the JPS had the house kept filling with smoke. Is
yeah,
that right?
Yeah, it's right. Yeah.
What that made me think of differently than I've thought of it in the past is that like, when these fire creatures say holy, 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 like it shakes. And then like, I mean, I think the smoke is emanating from them maybe, mm-hmm. right? So it's the actual speaking fills it. And then it sort of dissipates for a minute and everything calms down. And then the other one says, holy, holy, holy. And the temple
and
shakes and
again.
It fills up
yeah.
again. I just imagine like how terrified mm-hmm. you would be. And it sounded like, and also, I mean, terrified in that sense that, you know, we also often try to get the sense of fear in the Hebrew Bible.
Yeah.
That like,
yeah,
overwhelmed
exactly.
by the grandeur of it in a way that is really kind of like shakes you to your core.
Yes. No, I mean, that's exactly what I was just thinking is the relationship between the, you know, those ideas in the Hebrew language and in some ways in English. You know, we can say awesome, full of awe, it's great, and awful, full of awe, is
yeah
terrifying, you know, and this is what that is.
Yeah, Isaiah's having both of those things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you make of this in verse 5? Woe is me, I am lost.
Like, I mean, if you think about what's just happened here, is Isaiah has walked into the temple and there are these creatures here who are these great fiery creatures who are shaking the doorposts, and they are so respectful of God that they have covered their faces and their feet. And Isaiah's just walked in and like looked at God like, oh, hey, what's up? And I mean, I think this is what he means when he like, it's like, woe is me, you know, like I am lost. I think it's just like he realizes that he's done a thing that like you're not supposed to do. Like, that's how I read that is, I have done this thing that even the seraphim won't do, and I'm just like Isaiah, so this yeah. is the end of me. What do you think? What do you think is going on there?
I mean, I love how you tie that into the fact that he has, you know, as we start at the very beginning, with his own eyes, seen the Lord. I think I was thinking about it more generally, but I land in a very similar place, which is just, a human does not belong in this scene.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah, yeah, I like that.
Like, and...
Like it's like, I stepped into the wrong room.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah, like Isaiah is now sort of straddling two worlds. He has witnessed this thing, like this enormous holiness that, it, I mean, holy means like set apart. It is set apart from humans. And he has all of the uncleanness, all of the unholiness of being a human. And he just, I see this as he's recognizing that tension. Like, he's seeing this incredible thing, but he doesn't belong in this space.
I love that reading. And I think those two can go together pretty well.
Absolutely. Okay. So then moving on into verse 6. Then one of the seraphs flew over to me with a live coal, which he had taken from the altar with a pair of tongs. He touched it to my lips and declared, now that this has touched your lips, your guilt shall depart and your sin be purged away. Then I heard the voice of my Lord saying, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And I said, here I am, send me. So we've just had Isaiah saying that he is of unclean lips, you know, not in a state where he ought to be in this holy space and encountering this, all of the holiness that is in there. And then we have a fix.
Yeah.
Right? The seraph has a fix. It's a little bit of a weird fix, though, isn't it?
I mean, there's so many things just in that one little image, but like that it is fire, that it touches the lips, and that it is purifying. And I mean, there is an intimacy to that. Like, you have encountered this enormous glory of God, or, you know, God's robe and these fiery earthquake creatures, and then one of them touches your lips, which is like such an intimate place, like a intimate part of the body, mm-hmm. with this burning hot coal. Like there is just so much there. It's just even hard to get your head around it.
Yeah, it does seem like there is a recognition from the seraph that what Isaiah has said is true.
Yeah, that's
the
right.
The problem Isaiah has named is true.
Yes.
But there also is a response to it. It's not just, oh, now we're going to kick you out or now you have to die.
Yeah.
It's almost like there's, I mean, not an initiation ritual, but a sense of you can be more like us by encountering fire, maybe because they're fiery creatures. I don't know.
Having your lips touched with a burning coal is not a pleasant experience. I mean, I don't know that has ever happened to me, but I would like for it not to happen to me.
Yeah, that does not sound good.
So there is a painfulness to it, but there is also this kind of sense of graciousness or compassion that, like, this thing that you are unclean, in fact. And there's this thing that we can do that will make it so that you can be here and it will be okay. Mm-hmm. There's a real generosity to that on the part of the divine beings, I think.
So then we get this. Isaiah has this fiery cleansing experience.
Yeah.
And then immediately on the heels of that, here's the voice of God saying, "Whom shall I send? Who will go for us?"
Yeah.
And Isaiah answers with this profound, you know, "Hineni, here I am."
Yeah.
"Send me."
Yeah.
For what? Does he know what he's being sent for?
No, I mean, that's one of the things that's so interesting about Isaiah is he really, I mean, he has no idea what he has volunteered for here.
I think that's exactly right. Like, he has already recognized his inadequacies and they've been dealt with. So by the time there is a call for, you know, that there's apparently some role to be filled, there's a very clear sort of, you know, Hineni has this sort of at your service kind of,
yeah.
You know, you volunteer before you know what you're volunteering for.
Yeah.
Because of your relationship to the one asking, not because you're actually agreeing to the particular thing that they're asking for. That's my usual experience,
yeah,
of Hineni anyway, is that it's much more about the relationship between the asker and the respondent,
yeah,
than the task. And so here you can see how closely Isaiah is tied into this, is tied into his Lord, and is tied into like this overwhelming experience of holiness, and how he now feels so a part of it and sort of invited into it that he can have a role in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he says, I'm ready to go. And then,
yeah,
he gets the bad news about what he's going to have to do.
You kind of understand why the narrative lectionary ends right there, don't you?
I absolutely understand why the narrative,
yeah,
lectionary ends there. Yeah. But the text goes on.
It does.
Okay. So picking up in verse 9, "And God said, go say to that people, hear indeed, but do not understand. See indeed, but do not grasp. Dull that people's mind, stop its ears and seal its eyes. Lest seeing with its eyes and hearing with its ears, it also grasp with its mind and repent and save itself." So what is it that God is looking for someone to do?
So what Isaiah is supposed to go and say is those two lines in verse 9, "Say to the people," he is supposed to say, "keep listening, but do not comprehend. Keep looking, but do not understand."
Mm-hmm.
And then God goes on to instruct Isaiah, like, you need to prophesy in a way that makes the people not see and not hear so that they don't repent.
Mm-hmm.
Like, harden their hearts so that,
yeah,
they don't,
exactly,
save
harden
themselves.
Harden their hearts, yes. But instead of hardening the heart of who you would imagine is God's enemy, like Pharaoh,
right,
here it's harden the hearts of my people. That's tough to sit with.
It really is, yeah.
That's really tough.
And I, you know, I wonder what Isaiah thought when he when he got that commission. But yeah, it seems like God has decided that God is ready to, needs to punish the people, and God does not want the people to repent.
Right.
But God needs
has decided that this has to happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so God is sending a prophet to communicate to the people exactly so that they won't repent. And I don't quite know, like, I've often wondered, like, is God doing, like, due diligence there? Like, I'm supposed to send a prophet, and so here's a prophet that I'm going to send.
That's what it seems like. It totally feels like a due diligence period. You're right. Send a really bad home inspector who will say everything is fine. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to make a prophet. Yeah. Who's going to prophesy. It's not that Isaiah is to lie to them, I don't think. But it is that Isaiah is to, like, not prophesy in ways that are clear enough to be understood.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's right. And, you know, the rabbis read this text, the rabbis say it's impossible that this was the command. Like this, God could not, they can't sit with this command. And so they will not read this as imperative verbs, even though they are imperative verbs in Hebrew. They read them as imperfect, as though like, this is what is going to happen. The people will not understand, but not that Isaiah is supposed to cause that. But it's pretty clear that Isaiah is supposed to cause that.
No, I understand why one would do that theologically. Like, yeah, this is a complicated thing.
It is hard theologically. It's very hard. Yeah. All right. So then just the last couple of verses in this chapter, picking up in verse 11. I asked, "How long, my Lord?" And he replied, "Till towns lie waste without inhabitants and houses without people, and the ground lies waste and desolate, for the Lord will banish the population, and deserted sites are many in the midst of the land. But while a tenth part yet remains in it, it shall repent. It shall be ravaged like the terebinth and the oak, of which stumps are left even when they are felled. Its stump shall be a holy seed." So Isaiah has heard this command from God to prophesy in a way that they will not understand.
Yeah.
And his immediate response is, how long?
Yeah.
How long what? How long does he need to keep doing this?
Yeah, I think that's right. How long do I need to keep doing this? And, you know, in the Hebrew Bible, that sort of "how long, O Lord," is often used as a kind of cry of anguish.
Yeah.
And so I think both of those are probably in view. Like, oh my goodness, this prophecy is terrible, and how long do I have to do this? And at the same time, like, how long are you going to make your people suffer in the terrible way you have envisioned? So I don't think Isaiah does not relish the prophetic call that he has been given. He is wishing it to be over before it has begun, and he is recognizing the terrible nature of what God has said and what is about to happen. Mm-hmm. What do you make of, like, God's answer is not comforting?
No.
I mean, it's a little comforting at the end, but it starts out really not comforting. What do you do with God's response there?
I mean, God's response is, as I read it, until there has just been a whole lot of destruction.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just that the people are going to need to get a taste of it and somehow the taste is going to turn it around. Mm-hmm. It's almost like the destruction itself has to happen, not just as a deterrent to future bad behavior, but it's part of the work that God sees to be necessary.
Yeah, I mean, until a tenth part remains, so 90%.
Yeah.
Destruction.
Mm-hmm. And then there's how positively do you read that last part? Like, once there's a tenth that remains, does everything turn around in your reading?
Well, I mean, in the NRSV's translation is actually quite different than the NJPS.
I was going to say, I think the NJPS has a more positive reading of this than is necessarily merited.
Yeah. The NRSV is, "Even if a tenth part remain in it, it will be burned again.
Mm-hmm.
Like
yes.
a terebinth or an oak whose stump yes. remains standing when it is felled."
Yes.
And so, like, once we get rid of the 90%, if there's still 10% left, like, that's not good enough.
Right.
And then the very last line, "the holy seed is its stump." To me, that is, like, the notion that there is seed that remains is a tiny little bit of hope at the end. Mm-hmm. But everything has been cut all the way down to the stump. And the thing that remains is just the seeds for the future, but they are not, there's no plant yet remaining. There is just future plants are there.
Right, right. There is hope for the future, but everything that exists now is going to have to be destroyed.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Everything's got to be cut back. Everything's got to be burned. And then... Yeah, and then we can start over. So it's not that there is no future.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's just that the future requires the complete destruction of the present.
Just that. Yeah.
I don't know if it's interesting that there is burning that's happening here, and Isaiah has had his lips burned, and then here is a burning that takes place. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if the text is wanting us to make that connection, but it kind of connects in my head mm-hmm. that in order for Isaiah to do the thing that he was asked to do, he had to be burned. And now it seems like in order for Judah to do the things that they need to do, mm-hmm. they need to be burned and sort of made new again. And that both of these processes are exceedingly painful. And that on the other side of the painfulness, then there becomes this possibility of something else. But between here and the something else, there is this period of pain.
Okay, Bobby, we have traversed some spiritual ground today.
We have, yes.
So for today, what is a message that you would pull out for us to hear?
The place that's really kind of resonating with me today is about the nature of this as some kind of a call story for Isaiah, where he is starting into a new part of his prophecy, his career as a prophet of the Lord. And I mean, we're in chapter 6, so he's been prophesying for 5 chapters already. So he's already been doing some stuff. We might think of this as sort of a recommissioning or something like that. Mm-hmm. But however you think of it, as a recommission or as a commission, like the way that it takes place is really fascinating to me, and I think pretty instructive. And that is that it starts with Isaiah kind of beholding the glory of God in this way that, I mean, I love that language of I am lost or I am undone. Like that encountering with God is sort of disorienting to him and makes him realize his uncleanness. And so I think that sort of reorienting experience, you know, especially like if he's already been kind of carrying out some version of this call, to suddenly realize when he encounters God again that he needs to do it differently than he's been doing it. Like, I think there's something profound about kind of reorientation that's in this text for Isaiah. One of the things that I really love about this text is that Isaiah realizes immediately that he is unclean and unworthy to be in the presence of God. And God doesn't say, no, no, it's fine. But God also doesn't punish Isaiah or get rid of Isaiah. God says, here's the thing that you need in order to be able to function in the way, like to be in my presence. You need this coal. Mm-hmm. And so I love that the inadequacies, the imperfections that we bring with us, like God has ways of making those things okay. Like they might be painful, mm-hmm. but the pain is momentary in that sense. And so to recognize that we all have our faults, we all have our imperfections, we all have our uncleannesses and our sins, and that those need not stand in the way of doing God's work in the world, because God can overcome those, give us ways forward through those things. I love that, and I love the boldness with which Isaiah says, yeah, I'm up for whatever. Like, once he has sort of overcome his own sense of inadequacy, he just says, use me the way that I can be useful. And I think that that is a really profound thing. And for a person of faith to think, we may not always have a great sense of what exactly God can do with us in the world. But if we volunteer for the commission, then maybe we can find out.
Oh, I love that. I really like
if you
that.
End right there, it's a really beautiful kind of thing. Did you want to say something about that?
I mean, I love a lot of the things that you were saying, but I love the idea of this being sort of a call into the next chapter of his, of Isaiah's relationship to God. And I think that is also really true to life. Like, you know, many of us may start work in religious communities, but not have these kinds of profound experience. I mean, none of us have probably quite this profound of an experience. Yeah. These kinds of experiences of holiness, they might not come at the very beginning. They might come later, or there might be shifts over the course of our career. And I don't know. It seems really like true to life. It doesn't always start with you know, sitting in the skirts of the Lord in the temple. Maybe that'll come later.
Yeah.
Maybe that'll come later.
Yeah. There's lots more that I could say about this text, but I'm really curious what you're seeing when you read it for your community.
So since you spoke about the first beautiful part, maybe I'll speak about the harder second part. Really sort of picking up from this question of what is the role of destruction in creation, you know, and at this moment in particular, where, you know, you and I have commented many times that we feel that fault lines that have existed for a long time in our world, in our, you know, in American society, along lines of gender or race or socioeconomic class, you know, around issues of healthcare and, you know, compensation and, I mean, there are all kinds of things that have existed for a long time.
Yeah.
But we have, as a society, or at least I have, as a maybe naive member of society, tried to figure out little incremental adjustments I could make that would allow the fault line to continue being just sort of as it is, you know, put little bridges over it, patch things up the best way that we can. Various things in our in our situation today, you know, COVID being at the top of the list, but certainly not the only thing on the list, have made those fractures so evident. And it has led to an increase in suffering across the board. And I don't want to diminish that by saying like, oh, it's all for the good. This will all be great. But it has made it harder, I think, for us to just say, oh, we'll just tweak this little thing and then we can continue. Like, we can get a few more years out of this system the way it is. It's becoming clear that there are a lot of things in the system that we can't continue to squeeze more life out of.
Yeah.
And I do think that there can ultimately be a sense, there can be hope for, you know, post-traumatic growth after trauma, you know? And so I don't want to diminish, I don't want to diminish the trauma of that destruction, and I don't ever want to hope for that destruction. But I can see in our own time the ways in which sometimes it seems impossible to come to a better reality until things are really broken down so they can be rebuilt completely from the ground up.
Yeah, I think that's really well said. And I mean, that's really hard to hear and hard to think about. But I mean, that's what is in this text. And I think it is, the way that you have connected that to what's going on in our own situation, I think you can really see the connections there. And that one of the things that I really appreciate about Isaiah here is that he is not saying, yeah, let me go preach destruction.
He's not saying, oh, great.
He's saying, how long, oh, Lord? Like, I do not want to do this thing. I worry about people who are excited about destruction. And I mean, and there are people like that.
Yes.
Isaiah is not one of them. And yet he is speaking this truth that he has.
Yes.
But his goal is not to make it all better. His goal is to let it become what it is. Yeah, that's a hard word. That's a hard word.
I think why the narrative lectionary stops at 8.
That's exactly what I was about to say. Yeah.
And
if I were preaching this text, I don't know. Like, there's a nice sermon that ends at 8.
Yes, there is.
There is a more complicated, but maybe equally important one that goes all the way through.
Yeah.
All right, Amy. Well, next time we're in Jeremiah 36 and 31. And
is that where he's a bullfrog? No. Not those.
That's
chapters.
Not.
The, we didn't get the. We did the bullfrog chapters last year. No.
Yeah. our professor David Peterson, when we were at Emory, had a whole lecture about. It wasn't a whole lecture, but it was a good 10 or 15 minutes.
It was. He had a whole
about whether
about that.
Indeed Jeremiah was a bullfrog.
Well, I look forward to talking again next week. I hope y'all have a good one.
You too. I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Bible Worm. If you'd like to hear the rest of our conversation about this text, join our Patreon at the Extended Worm level or higher to get access to extended episodes. You'll also find other goodies like early access, video lectures, weekly liturgies, and more, starting at just $4 per month. Visit patreon.com/BibleWormPodcast for details.
Bible Worm is produced by Bobby Williamson and edited by Joel and Laura Becker. Our theme song is sung by Colin Bagby. We are grateful to all our supporters for helping us keep the podcast going. A special thank you to our executive producer, Fox Valley Presbyterian Church in Geneva, Illinois.
Join us again next week when we'll be discussing Jeremiah chapters 36 and 31. Until then, keep on digging.